Part 15, Chapter 3. As the days wore on into weeks, it became obvious to the council, originally composed of the parson, the schoolmaster, the historian, and Robert the Fox, and now augmented by several clan chiefs who left deputies in Scotland, that Johnny was brooding about something. He would smile at them from his bed and talk to them when spoken to, but there was something deep in his eyes that was dull and moody. Chrissy tried not to let them come very often, and when they did, she was a bit impatient with them if they overstayed. Some of the Russians and some Swedes were rebuilding parts of the academy due to the desperate need for pilots. Until the ancient Capitol building in Denver could be rebuilt, the council had a room at the academy. They could get to both the compound and the underground military base from there, and all their berthing quarters were there. At this particular meeting, Robert the Fox was walking up and down, his kilt flaring out each time he turned, his claymore held snug enough by an ancient officer's belt from the base, which also held a Smith & Wesson, knocking against chairs.
Something is bothering him. He's not like the old Johnny.
Does he think we are doing something wrong?
Said the chief of Clan Fergus.
No, it isn't that,
said Robert the Fox.
There's not a scrap of criticism for anyone in his makeup. It's just he seems worried.
The parson cleared his throat.
It just could be his sight has something to do with it. He cannot much move his right arm, and he cannot walk as yet. He is, after all, used to being about, and very briskly as well. After all, the lad had a dreadful time of it. All alone, injured. I can't think how he managed. All that time in a cage earlier. You're all expecting too much, too fast, gentlemen. He is a brave spirit, and I have faith.
Could be wary over the possibility of a cyclo counterattack,
said the chief of Clan Argyle.
We must reassure him somehow,
said the chief of Clan Fergus.
Heaven knows we are working hard enough on planetary affairs.
And they were. The World Federation for the Unification of the Human Race had been formed from those Johnny had not accepted for the group that had come with him to America. Some 200 young Scots and another 50 oldsters had done their beginning work well. In two dangerous but successful raids, one to the site of an ancient university named Oxford, and another to a similar ruin at Cambridge, they had obtained language books and a mound of material on other countries. They had worked out where isolated groups of humans might still be, and had formed up a unit for each language they thought might still be in use. Their selection was proving not far off, and ruler-bruised hands attested to the diligence of their study. They called themselves coordinators, and they were making a vital contribution all over the world where groups were being found. The current estimate was that there were nearly 35,000 human beings left on Earth, an astonishing number that, the council agreed, was far too great for any one town. The groups were mostly survivors who had withdrawn to mountainous places, natural fortresses their forebears had mined, as in the case of the Rockies. But some were in the frozen north in which the cyclos had had no interest, and some were simply overlooked strays. The duty of the council, as they saw it, was to preserve the tribal and local customs and government and install over all of it a clan system, appointing local leaders as clan chiefs. The coordinators spread the news and were extremely welcome and successful. The hard-worked pilots were ferrying in chiefs and visitors and simply anyone who got on their passenger planes. If there were too many going or coming, they simply told them to wait until next week, and that was fine. But there was no really organized forward motion. Local control of the tribes was often slack. Some had retained literacy in their language, some had not. Most of them were poor, half-starved, ragged. The one incredible fact that after over 1,000 years there was freedom from cyclos, even if possibly temporary, united them in a wave of hope. They had once gazed from their mountains on the ruins of cities they dared not visit. They had looked upon fertile plains and great herds they dared not benefit from. They had seen no hope whatever for their dying race. And then, suddenly, men from the sky, speaking their language, telling them of the remarkable feats that led to possible freedom, had brought them soaring hope and reburgeoning pride in their race. The Council's existence they accepted. They joined it and, with radios parked on rocks and in huts, communicated with it. They all had one question. Was the Johnny McTyler, of whom the coordinator spoke, a part of this council? Yes, he was. Good. No more questions. But the council well knew that Johnny was not an active part of the council now. Completely aside from the political significance of it, every council member was himself personally concerned for Johnny. There were all kinds of things happening over the world. Most of the actions taken without even informing the council. People were moving about. A group of South Americans with baggy pants and flat leather hats, swinging wide lariats and riding almost as well as Johnny once did, had suddenly walked off a plane with their women and lariats and saddles and said, through their Spanish-speaking Scot coordinator, that they were llaneros, or gauchos, and they knew cattle, but would find out what to do with buffalo, and were taking over the management of the vast herds to preserve them and to make sure the people at the compound and base were properly fed. Two Italians from the Italian Alps had shown up and taken over the commissary after making peace with the old women. Five Germans from Switzerland had shown up and opened a factory in Denver to salvage and service man equipment such as knives and tools, you name it. And if you sent it to them, they would make it shiny and working and send it back. This put a freight line into an already overburdened pilot zone. Three Basques showed up and simply started making shoes. The difficulty was that Basque as a language had been omitted by the coordinators, and the shoemakers were learning English and Cyclo while they turned out shoes from the hides the South Americans dedicatedly furnished them. Many others came in. Everybody wanted to help, and simply helped.
There is no control of it,
Robert the Fox told Johnny one day in the hospital room. Johnny simply gave him a small smile and said,
why control them?
The historian, except for Johnny's account of the drone, which was too sketchy to be called history, was getting bogged down in assembling tribal histories of the last 1,000 or more years. The coordinators sent him all kinds of stuff, and he couldn't even keep it in order. Some serious-eyed Chinese from a mountain fastness there had shown up to help him, and they were furiously studying English, but were not of much help yet. It seemed at first that language would be an obstacle, but it soon became clear that the future educated person would speak three languages: Cyclo for technical matters, English for arts, humanities, and government, and their own tribal language, if not English. The pilots chattered Cyclo at each other. All their equipment was in Cyclo, as well as their manuals and navigation and related skills. There was a lot of protest at speaking the language of the hated Cyclos, until the historian learned that Cyclo as a language was really a composite of words and technical developments stolen from other peoples in the universes. And there never had been a basic language called Cyclo. People were glad of that, and thereafter learned it more willingly, but they liked to refer to it as Techno. The parson had his own problems. He had about 40 different religions on his hands. They had one thing in common: the myths of the conquest 1,000 or more years ago. Otherwise, they were miles apart. He had witch doctors and medicine men and priests and such flooding his doorstep. He knew very well the wars that can develop out of different faiths, and he was not going to evangelize any one of them. Man wanted peace. He explained to them that man, being divided and internally at war, had advanced too slowly as a culture, and so had been wide open to an invasion from elsewhere. They all agreed man should not be at war with man. The myths, well, they knew the truth of it now. They were happy to abandon those myths. But on this question of which gods and which devils were valid, well, the parson had neatly handled the whole thing for the moment. He would disturb no beliefs at all. Every one of these tribes was demanding to know what was the religion of Johnny McTyler. Well, he wasn't really of any religion, the parson told them. He was Johnny McTyler. Instantly, and without exception, Johnny McTyler became part of their religions. And that was that. But Johnny was lying a bit wan, trying each day at Chrissy's and McKendrick's persuasion to walk, to use his arm. And when the parson tried to tell him he was getting woven into the pantheon of about 40 religions, he said nothing. He just lay there, not much life or interest showing in the depths of his eyes. The council was not having a happy time of it.